Hey, this is Frank, author of the Host Deep Dive book, and you're listening to my buddy Speed and John on the Virtual Speaking Podcast.
Let's do this.
What is virtualization?
You're gonna learn today.
Innovate like a startup, deliver like an enterprise.
I hope you're coffeeed up and ready because it's gonna be a great day.
I know you're going to dig this.
Oh, yeah.
You're listening to the Virtually Speaking Podcast with Pedro Lero and John Nicholson.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Virtually Speaking Podcast, episode number 67. My name is Pete Fletcher, a.k.a. Pedro Arrow, and joining me once again is Mr. John Nicholson. John, how you doing, man?
I'm surviving. I've got, you know, multiple jackets on, my dog in my lap. I need a space heater, Pete. It's the winter blizzard apocalypse, the quarter inch of snow. I mean, we're barely holding on in Houston.
Snowmageddon 2018, Houston style. I like it. So, John, joining us today is the co-author of the Host Resources Deep Dive. We had him in before to talk about the book, and today he's going to come and join us to talk about resource management, Mr. Frank Denneman. Frank, welcome back, buddy.
Hi, guys. Thank you for having me.
I feel like I need to go hide all the overcommitment and wasted resources I'm abusing in the lab right now. Like, better set everything to fully automated before Frank catches me.
Yeah, you're still getting through. I'm holding it right now. It's still sitting on my desk. I use it more as a reference as much as I'm not going page by page, but how is the Host Resources Deep Dive book going for you?
It's seriously going insane. So recently we teamed up with VMUG and with Rubrik, and we said, let's share the information via a free ebook. So when you sign up at hostdeepdive.com, you can actually get the ebook for free.
Oh, right? Nice.
Full version, everything. Yeah, so that's insane. And more than 10,000 people already took us up on that offer. So it's going crazy.
Oh, I'm going to do that for sure. That's a lot easier to reference than thumbing through this heavy book. And plus, this book is so heavy.
Well, it's like a badge of honor to have that book on your desk. Right. And you should have it on your desk at work so everybody can marvel at the level of expertise that you have accumulated with this book. Right.
Mine's a little soggy from, diving with it off the coast of Bali.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
I will figure out how to get you a new one, John.
Yeah, maybe you're better off just giving him the ebook. That's probably a little safer. Anyway, Frank, we're so glad to have you on again. Recently, you posted on Twitter an interesting post, and it got a lot of feedback. A lot of folks were answering this question. Do you design your cluster with memory overcommitment in mind? Now, the responses were somewhat close. Most folks said no. Some other folks had good reasons, test and dev, etc. But it got me thinking about resource management and how VMware has always handled this. Has anything changed, possibly, that might have prompted you to take this survey in the first place?
So the interesting thing is we changed something in DRS in vSphere 6.5, and it made me realize that, hey, DRS is actually used primarily for the old reason of virtualization. I don't actually want to say old, but it's basically the premise of virtualization. So going back to mainframe errors, and now this is going to be a little bit of a historical lesson, if you look at where companies were coming from a mainframe, they basically bought time on a system, and typically that annoyed a lot of business units because they wanted to run their workloads and they couldn't. And now go back to the 90s and the x86 computers, they became very, very powerful back in the time, right? So now they thought, some brilliant minds thought, I don't need to have that mainframe. I can run my workload on an x86 computer, which is mine, and I can do whatever I wanted to do, right? So that was the explosion in the mid-90s of those systems. So I worked for a company who had over 1,000 machines. Funny thing was, they didn't believe in rack systems, so they had desk models, basically tower models.
PCs, yeah.
So, yeah. Well, a compact or a digital or whatever, but still it was a tower model. So we had endless rows of tables because each tower had its own monitor and its own keyboard. Was very efficient, of course. And we had a massive data center full of them. And that's what most people realized in the beginning of the 2000s is that, hey, we're only utilizing on average this system for 3 to 5%, right? hey, that's where VMware started to make sense, or at least, well, that's where VMware started to become a company. And at one point, ESX was created. So the premise of virtualization was, let's use a more powerful x86 server and consolidate all these workloads. Now, the key was, because every workload was only using 3-5%, we can pour on a lot of these workloads on one system because we only have to share the resources once the workload becomes active, right? And we did that for a long, long time. But because we were so used to virtualizing applications and workloads, we started to recognize other benefits: availability, mobility, but also automation, right? And soon that took over. So instead of thinking about, I want to consolidate my workload, I'm virtualizing just for the sake that I can move my workload. I can detach it from hardware. I can move my workloads wherever I want it, right? vMotion came along. Long distance vMotion came along. We could, at one point, vMotion without shared storage, without shared networking, between vCenters. We can do all those type of things, right? And that made a lot of companies realize that, hey, one of the key problems that I'm facing is memory, right? If I want to overcommit memory, I have to share memory. And typically, that can lead to problems. Typically, it doesn't, because there are many, many memory reclamation techniques inside the hypervisor that are very good at their job. But if, excuse my friends, the shit hits the fan, it's a lot of problems, right? So a lot of architects are, and that was my question, that's a long intro, but that was my question: do you actually design your cluster for this? Do you still want to do memory overcommitment, or have you moved on? Well, it's always a budget question as well, right? But most responses were, no, I'd rather spend money. Basically, I want to do a CapEx solution rather than dealing with an OpEx problem, right?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah. So, thank you. So the thing is, if you look at DRS right now, VMware DRS, vSphere DRS, that's actually focused on active. So it is built on the premise of, I need to consolidate active workloads and I need to load balance on the activity of VMs. Well, it doesn't make sense when your vSphere cluster is not designed to do memory overcommitment. So I had this discussion on Reddit, and somebody said, yeah, they can do whatever they want because they have the memory available. And I they were talking about pets and cattle. And I said, well, see a VM that runs in a cluster that has no memory overcommitment, see them as free range chickens. They can basically walk around and grab the memory they want because there's plentiful, right? We have designed the environment for your living space. Now, DRS in vSphere 6.5 can actually be tuned just by using a simple option in the UI to take memory consumption into consideration for load balancing and placement instead of active. So the whole behavior of your cluster becomes different.
Yep. I mean, because originally VMware virtualization in general, the idea was to consolidate workloads, like you said, but it became much more powerful than just a way to consolidate resources. It was more of a way to have mobility and disaster recovery. So I think the focus kind of shifted a little bit in terms of how virtualization, but also how DRS can still be powerful, but maybe just not for its intended purpose originally, right?
Yeah. And just by toggling it to a different behavior, you align that service, one of the most used features in the vSphere clustering suite, to actually behave as you designed your cluster. So figure out where to place this VM based on its memory consumption, basically the memory it touched once, right? So you know that, because typically a workload spikes at one point due to load correlation, getting the output of another system as the input for your operation, or load synchronicity. Basically, that happens when a lot of systems are getting active due to the fact that something happens. For example, when everybody logs on to their computer at 9 o'clock in the morning, your Active Directory global catalog is getting very busy, but your Outlook server is also getting hammered, right? And because there's this interaction and both systems start to become very active, and you need to have those resources available. And if you don't use memory reservations, you just need to get the memory from host. Now, by using by basically tuning DRS to look for consumed memory, you don't have to worry about that spike because typically it already took that into account because it touched it once, right? It touched the memory already.
Yeah.
I guess one other thing to think about though from the VM placement, you know, automation or just balancing out, even in a case where you have plenty of memory for everything, is by balancing out the VMs and their placement, there's also some things under the hood, like for instance, storage queues on HBAs and things like that on the back end, that you'll be effectively balancing some of the back end demands. Even though you're balancing placement by memory and compute and trying to even those VMs out, you're also going to be evening out some things under the hood, will be a secondary benefit of this capability.
Yeah, so that's an interesting point, right? Especially when you have a centralized storage array, you want to manage those queues. Now, for example, in VMware, we have storage I/O control, which you can use to actually understand where are the VMs and which VMs need to have priority to communicate. But within DRS, this is something a lot of people do not realize, is that DRS is something called a pair balancing, pairwise balancing. And that means that it actually looks at the utilization of the host, also from a memory and a CPU perspective, of course. And if it's beyond a certain percentage, it will start to rebalance, right? So you don't have your one host being extremely populated and another totally underutilized, right? So this is due to the aggressive slider. So by typical, you have it's set by default onto 3, so in the middle. And that means there's a gap of 20%. Which is tolerated. That means that between hosts within the cluster, there can be a 20% load difference. If you move that slider to the right, you basically decrease the tolerance levels. So 10%, 0%, basically that's it. But if that's not good enough for you and you want to peanut butter spread your VMs over the VMs, there's this possibility as well. Again, so it start to count more, like I want to have these virtual, I want to have an even number of VMs on host, but it always takes the utilization into consideration because 10 VMs on one host and 10 VMs on another host looks balanced, but from an activity perspective, it could not be balanced due to the activity of the individual workload, of course, that those VM run internally.
Yeah, good question. So do we need to be more application aware? Like talk about like, does it depend on the workload or do we try to do this? Because I was thinking about VMware Cloud on AWS. I mean, this is a service now, right? They're handling a lot of those resources for you, right? They're handling all the setup. They're handling all the provision of the VMs. And so does this apply to also to VMware Cloud on AWS? Does this make a difference as to like what applications I put possibly on VMware Cloud on AWS versus on-prem? Or do you think this just you can apply this globally?
Well, that's a good question. My idea of, or the way I look at VMC, and especially from a role changing perspective for our customers, is that customers that deal with virtualization are infrastructure focused, right? They need to manage the host. They need to manage the connection to the storage, or sometimes they actually need to manage the storage if it's not an HCI environment. And they need to do all these type of things to get the infrastructure running. But when you look at VMC, it actually becomes now a more of a resource management type of role. Because like you said, VMC, it's a service. So we take care of the hardware. We take care of the infrastructure.
Yeah.
And not only that, we can leverage the power of VMC fleet management coupled with the AWS infrastructure. And we can say, okay, you want another host? Here, just right-click on the cluster, say expand or add another host, and within 5 minutes, you have a new physical host. So I did I posted the questions a while ago on Twitter saying, what is the average lead time of your company to actually rack and stack and deploy a physical host in your data center from the moment you know that you need one, right? So I need one. How long will it take to actually have that thing operational?
Yeah, get it approved, get it shipped, get it unpacked, racked, stacked, configured, and then up and running in production.
Yeah, and that's seriously, that was an interesting topic as well, because besides the time itself, what was interesting to me is that a lot of customers, they face this problem because the process itself, or the lead time of the process itself, is inconsistent as well. Now, we all know that the best user experience is to have consistent performance. you can have an extreme good peak performance, but if you don't have that all the time,
yeah,
and you have peak performance and bad performance and peak performance and bad performance, nobody's getting happy from that.
Yeah.
Because one time it works, the other time it doesn't. Now, if you have a consistent performance, you can count on it, right? You know what you're basically can expect. Now, what happens is that a lot of reactions were typically it's between 3 to 4 weeks, but it also can be 12 weeks. Right. And that will drive you crazy. Right. Because if you have a project coming up and they say, I need to have resources, and we're like, OK, well, I might have it in 3 weeks, but I might have it in 12 weeks. you sound unbelievable. Right. The project team cannot count on you. Right.
You weren't trying to buy 4 terabyte SSDs last year, because then suddenly that becomes, you know, a 6 month lead time, depending on who you're talking to.
Exactly. And that's crazy. Right. So it's not only the fact that the lead time is extremely long. So on average, it actually takes 86 days for most companies to go through this full process. 86 days.
Wow.
Right? So we do it in VMC within 5 minutes. That's seriously awesomeness right there. Yeah. Right? And the thing is, 5 minutes and that thing works. So the networking is already configured. You got your logical networks connected. Your vSAN data store is being expanded. Everything works within 5 minutes. Physical hardware. Jesus.
Meanwhile, I'm still trying to figure out which GBICs I need to order and, you know, figure out, yeah, how much power I have available. And, oh, gosh.
That's curious to me. So, like, we have internal systems that are nested that are software, right? Like, so I can spin up an entire vSAN lab with, like, 6 nodes in 5 minutes. And it's great, but it's all software. But you guys can do it with hardware. So I don't understand how that, I don't even understand how that works.
Well, that's pure magic, baby. So
you have like little people waiting for people to click a button and then, oh, all right, turn this one on.
So you laugh, but I had a friend who worked at one of the earliest of the vCAN cloud providers, and they had like a bare metal provisioning option. And it was this guy who basically, he's like, yeah, I'm running down the racks, you know, slamming something in and trying to get it cabled and, you know, online in a couple hours whenever someone hit that buy button. So,
yeah. So, but seriously, I'm still getting amazed when I see this happening within moments. You have this thing in your cluster, right? So once you get used to this idea of having physical hardware available for you, think about how this actually translates to your behavior as an administrator from a resource perspective. Instead of saying, I need 4 hosts now and I need 8 hosts in 2 months, typically due to get away from the inconsistency, now you can basically look at your cluster and actually start to monitor the resource consumption, right? Now, this is just from a manual perspective. What we're working on, and this is a future release, so it's not out right now, and we're working on this, so no promises, but it's on the horizon. We are thinking about expanding this in the algorithm of DRS. So instead of saying a threshold, I need to have my DRS cluster balanced, have another threshold that say, okay, I want to have it balanced, but what if all the hosts are utilized for an X percent of utilization? Let's say 80, for example, right? I'm just grabbing this out of the thin air. Let's say it's 80%. You can basically say, if the cluster utilization is 80%, I want you to add another physical host.
Oh, man. That's
or
sweet.
2 or 3 or 4, right? So you can actually define a maximum number of hosts in your cluster. Otherwise, you might get into a loop, add more, and you wake up and you have like 26 hosts in your cluster. You might not want to do that. You might want to do that if you have the absolute need, and not that the developer is going crazy. But the reality is, you can automate this, right? A colleague of ours did this with Alexa and with an IoT button, where he clicked on the IoT button of Amazon, and every time when he clicked, it fired up a Lambda script that actually added another host. Just by a click of a button, really a click of a button.
Man.
He did it first with Alexa, but everybody got like crazy, like, Alexa, could you add another host? Yeah. Okay, we got it now.
Yeah. You better set a password on it. This is kind of like, if I don't set a password on mine and my friends over having a couple beers, they're going to start ordering some obscene things on my account. like, wait a minute. We had a couple beers in the office, and suddenly we've got, you know, 400 hosts in the cluster. Wait. No, one other thing, you talking about that whole purchasing cycle and it being drawn out, is in the storage world, we think of all these different layers of overcommitment. So, you know, thick storage on the pool, thick on the VMFS volume, you know, all these other areas where everyone reserves capacity just in case. And a lot of times that nests up to where you end up with really poor utilization on the back end if everyone's reserving everything everywhere. But taking this analogy to the host world, if you've got, you know, at the end of it, you've got the application vendor who will say, this database needs 16 cores and 64 gigs of RAM. And then you've got the actual app owner who will then, you know, arbitrarily add something to that just in case. And then the DBA will add, say, you know, I think I always need 10 terabyte volumes just in case. And then you've got the actual, you know, guy, the VM admin or the server purchaser who goes, well, we should probably order an extra server just in case because it's going to take so long. The longer that procurement cycle is drawn out, the more everyone puts padding into their request. And when a request is effectively nested through four or five different teams, there's probably a huge amount of over ordering and overcapitalization that has to be done to meet those requests versus kind of like the early days of virtualization when people would give you insane requests. You'd say, let's put in a VM and we'll scale up around need. Now with the cloud, we're taking that model instead of to the VM, but to the host ordering process.
Yeah. And the thing is what you said with the padding, right? You can do this pretty much on the spot, right? So, okay, I need more hosts. Here you go. You got more hosts, right? So it becomes, this is the thing. It really becomes you go from a CapEx model to an OPEX model, right? So it's not about going through the whole process of explaining why you need it, especially with the DRS, the automatic DRS function, right? It actually shows we need it because the percentage, the statistics say, or the metrics say it needed, right? That's a different type of story when you go to your boss.
And so algorithms we trust.
Yeah.
I trust that algorithm, not my VDI admin, who swears to me that he's going to have 20,000 users show up next month. And do I really order 3 racks of servers? Or do I go, here's a 4-node cluster in VMC. And you know what? As you need them, they'll just magically appear.
Yeah. So the only thing what you need to think about is, and that's always the case when you go from a DC to a cloud service, is how do I deal this from an administrative process in a financial process, right? Because typically you go from a CapEx model to an OPEX model, but most customers are already used to this idea, right? But it shows, I think, a lot of benefit. And now the cool part of this all is now we're always talking about adding more hosts, but sometimes you need hosts just for a while. Black Friday, end of month,
end of fiscal year rollovers.
Exactly, right? So now you can basically add those hosts to actually provide you that capacity. The moment you don't need it, you can basically consolidate those virtual machines on the hosts that are necessary and remove those hosts again so you don't pay for it, right? That's the brilliant stuff. So you're not like, once I add, I cannot scale it down. You can, right? So less risk. I can add once I need it and remove it once I don't need it. That is a different type of approach for your data center from a VI admin, I think, right?
Yeah, that changes the process for resource management drastically, you know, on-premises versus a cloud model like AWS.
Well, and I think we just have to admit that we don't know what we're doing with greenfield deployments, because so many times people come to you and say, oh, I need all these resources. You're like, what's this for? You know, are you extrapolating? Were you? Well, we don't know. We're just guessing. It's a new app. And we heard someone else use that many resources. And it's like, you know what? Let's throw it in VMC. Let's figure out what it actually uses. Who knows? It might actually, maybe we decide to later vMotion it back in house if it was, you know, it fits with one of our existing resource buckets and financial models, or if it is really that erratic, if it's highly elastic, or there's other reasons, geolocality, other things, we're just going to leave it there and let it, you know, grow as needed.
And that's an excellent point you're making, John, because a lot of people always say the next technology will destroy the previous technology. I think I said this earlier on your show. I don't think that's the case. I think everything will become like a hybrid solution. So I think a lot of customers who are moving towards a cloud provider, let's say they're moving towards VMC, they still have their own DC. There are a couple of customers, of course, that are moving, that are applying a data center zero model, basically moving away from operating your own data centers. But I think a lot of customers will operate their own data centers. Now, and here's the key, that data center will change drastically, I believe, within the next 5 years. The design for it, the use for it, right? Because what you need to understand is you need to ask the question, where do I need to run this workload? Is it necessary to run it in-house, like you said, due to, for example, data gravity, right? I want to get the compute as close as where the data is generated, for example, to support a manufacturing process. Or can I move this workload into the cloud because it's just a generic workload, which I don't really need to have on-prem? That's a different type of approach for your data center design. So bias, right? Where am I going to run my workload? What's the necessity, right? And I think that's going to be something that will create a mind shift for many, many of the infrastructure administrators.
Oh, yeah. That's interesting. So people are doing this data center zero model. People are migrating their data centers to AWS. That seems kind of scary. I mean, first of all, there's no room for downtime. So it's got to be a completely non-disruptive migration. Is that something that, and on top of that, getting to the cloud, it seems like doing a migration like that could be very network intensive?
Yeah, it can. So that's one of the things, right? You have to understand your workload, and especially intercommunication between workloads. Which workload communicates with which other workload? Because especially when you have a long migration process, right? You don't want to have network traffic tromboning from cloud to the on-prem and back again, because you just decided to move one of the application of the entire application stack to the cloud. You have to understand what you're dealing with, right? So getting intricate details about communication between applications is imperative to have a successful migration strategy, even if you do hybrid or you do a data center zero model. Now, the cool part is, like you said, Pete, what we can do with VMC, you can actually migrate between two data centers with vMotion. It's just a long distance vMotion. Well, just within parentheses, of course, because it's brilliant stuff to actually, if you think about it. But you can live migrate without downtime a workload. Like the customers I'm talking to are doing bulk migrations, and typically they say that's a lot of data what we're moving, because we need to move, and this is something that I think you guys are very interested in. You need to move from a storage solution to a vSAN solution, right? That's an interesting thing from not only from a technology perspective, but also from, again, the operational perspective and how what type of mind shift comes into mind. It's very easy to understand, but you have to grasp the idea, right? And I want to talk about this later. But the interesting thing is, when you do bulk migration, so you lift and shift a lot of data. Typically, what a lot of customers are doing right now is saying, okay, I just use the service window. I will indicate that these workloads go offline, and I will transfer them. Now, if I'm powering down those workloads, I have a denial of service. Now, there are some tools, and that's something we're working on right now. For example, HCX. That's a tool that allows, by using vSphere application, to actually keep the virtual machines up and running, get most of the data over, assign a specific cutoff point, like I'm going to migrate at the end of February, right? So we enable it now. It starts to move the data. And when it's the 28th, the end of February, they're going to shut down those virtual machines, and they're going to move the deltas, just the last bit that is different between on-prem and in cloud, and then spin them up, and you're good to go. That is some of the brilliant stuff. And I think that's the brilliant stuff of VMC, is that we're using all these technologies that we've been perfecting for years and years. Think about long distance vMotion. How long is that available?
Yeah.
Now it makes sense, right? VMotioning between virtual networks. Now it makes sense. Data replication with vSphere replicator. Awesome stuff. We've been using it for years. So it's not new. It's tried and tested features, right?
Oh, yeah.
Coming back to HSX, that is something I think is a really underappreciated product and some of its capabilities. I ended up on a plane flight with one of the cloud providers architects who was using it. And he was talking about just some of the incredible amounts of throughput that it could sustain from a VPN, some of the WAN acceleration capabilities. It's really a cheat code in terms of migrations. I know one large airline provider who was leveraging it and they've basically cut their migration time to, you know, a quarter. It was going to be, you know, it was one financial quarter instead of a year was kind of the delta in terms of change that they were looking at.
Wow, that's insane. So one of the things that I was recently at a customer, and they are moving a lot of workloads to VMC, and we discussed how vSAN works, right? And that was an interesting thing, because what I noticed is that there's this shift in going from an infrastructure service to a VM focused service. So you, for example, with the object-based storage, now you can apply policies to that particular object, right?
Yeah.
And we talked about RAID levels and we talked about replication. And I'm like, no, you don't have to apply a replication to that LUN, because there is no LUN, right? There's one data store. And yeah, but what about RAID? Well, that's per object, right? So what's an object? Well, like a VMDK. And it needed some time. Well, the guys got it. But the interesting thing is that mind shift is interesting. Right. And I think you guys have are seeing this on a daily basis.
Oh, yeah. We all know.
LUNs suck.
Yeah, that's a big consideration, right? Because now you're shifting to this object-based storage platform. And so if you haven't been already on something like vSAN already, if you haven't, or vVols, where you're taking advantage of storage policy-based management, moving over to the cloud, you now have that at your disposal. So that's going to definitely change the way you manage your resources just by doing storage policy-based management, right?
Well, and really thinking about this, you know, the previous discussion we had about how quickly hardware shows up, you know, collapsing that procurement, we've got to also collapse the deployment phase. And thinking about all the original layers that used to be in that deployment process as a storage admin, you know, you had disks that went into RAID that went into pools that went into FC targets that then had zone mappings, you know, or LUNs added onto them. LUNs that, you know, those would then be extended into zone mappings, maybe in a director, and then a director would have to be connected to, you know, atop a rack, a fabric extender, or so forth. And then that would then have to have its actual host HBAs and EMPIV virtualization, other things. All of these layers. And the documentation for this, and at least in my experience, often ends up being a really ugly spreadsheet. In fact, you yeah. typically need to use the 64-bit version of Excel to have enough RAM to handle how big the spreadsheet has built. And you need enough color tags that if John looks at it, you know, too quickly, he'll get, you know, motion sickness. And, you know, while I'm sitting there under the desk throwing up, some storage graybeards, you know, mumbling to me about how I'll get my sea legs eventually and be able to handle, you know, staring at the raw awesome power of his documentation.
Yeah.
This guy also has about 2 feet of printed out paper and documentation of all these spreadsheets sitting on his desk. I think the goal of, you know, that type of storage documentation was, if you produce enough of it, you can hide under it, you know, during lunch, you know, under that pile of paper of all these different layers in storage.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
I worked at a customer who actually had a process to actually secure that spreadsheet, because that's typically that array hosted also the file systems. But that spreadsheet could not be saved on that array, because if that array fails, they couldn't redesign their array, because that file, that spreadsheet that contained all the information was also on that array. So we had a contingency plan for the Excel spreadsheet. Think about that.
The holy Torah.xls protected.
Yeah, how deep does the rabbit hole really goes, right?
Yeah, I love it. All that goes away, right? You just go into a cloud model, or even if you're just using vSAN with storage policy-based management. But yeah, you get it, right? So that's the idea. Everything is just managed by policy. So it's repeatable and it's automated for you. So you don't have to even worry about all those functionalities, and you don't have to protect your Excel spreadsheet.
If we're gonna procure faster, we're also gonna need to be able to deploy and manage faster. So yeah, that makes sense.
Very cool. All right, so yeah, this is good content. Is this gonna somehow find its way into your VMworld sessions this year, you think?
Yeah, I think so. I think the call for papers is going to open up pretty soon. So for everybody there who's listening, think about your next topic, whether or not you want to present on VMworld, of course.
Oh, yeah.
So one of the things that I'm going to present, I'm going to ask Niels to join me again on stage for the vSphere Host Resources Deep Dive Part 3.
Oh, yeah.
And another cool thing that I can announce is that both Duncan and I are working again on the clustering deep dive book. So updated to the latest and the greatest version. And we got a new author as well. Niels is such a brilliant guy when
yes,
it comes to networking. So we asked him, why don't you take the networking stuff for your account on this book?
Nice.
So Niels is going to join us as well. So one thing that we want to do at VMworld, we're hoping to do, is to do some sort of like a resource kit, but then in a spoken type of fashion. Do the host resource deep dive first, and then go on to a clustering deep dive as well, all in a session form.
Hey, so maybe this time you can have John and I come in and we can do the audio, you know, do the audio book for you in John and my voice.
That's a good idea. So John, are you doing Duncan's voice then?
Yeah, you know, I'm trying to think of how to even do the Duncan accent.
The Duncan accent.
Don't do an Austin Powers type of thing, because that's way off. We don't talk about smokes and pancakes whatsoever.
Didn't Duncan get like mistaken as Irish in his feedback of like, I didn't understand the Irish guy or whatever?
Yeah. So both Duncan and me are being, our accent is placed all over the world, from South Africa, which I can understand, to Irish, Portuguese, Australian, everything.
Australian? Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that person didn't go out too much. So,
or foreigner.
I love it. Well, Frank, man, thanks so much for coming and joining us again. You always have an open ticket to come on the Virtually Speaking podcast, and we look forward to seeing you at VMworld.
I appreciate it. Thank you, guys.
All right. Well, that music tells me it's time to go. And so if you want to get in touch with us, send us an email at podcast@vmware.com. Subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice by searching Virtually Speaking Podcast. You can catch this and all episodes at vspeakingpodcast.com. A huge thanks to co-author of Host Resources Deep Dive, Mr. Frank Dennerman. We'll see you next week. But until then, bye for now.
Lungs suck.
See?
Storage is cool.
Oh, yeah.
Enough of this jibber jabber.